This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. One of the cornerstones of Christian faith is the belief that Jesus of Nazareth rose from the dead. His resurrection is a sign of eternal life for those who follow the faith. UNC Charlotte Professor James Tabor has examined an ancient tomb in Jerusalem that shows the first evidence of Christian faith in the resurrection. But the tomb's proximity to another one, the so-called Jesus family tomb, raises an interesting question. Has the actual burial place of Jesus been found? James Tabor is chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and co-author of the book, The Jesus Discovery. And he joins me from WFAE in Charlotte. Welcome, James.
Thanks, Frank. Good to be with you.
Tell us about this discovery. Tell us about the tomb, first of all.
Well, there are two tombs, as you've just mentioned, so let's call them A and B. Let's talk about B. It's under a condominium building. It was actually uncovered in 1981 by bulldozers building. It was immediately covered back up because of religious protests, so it's been intact under that building now since 1981, so 30 years or so. And 2 years ago, we applied through my university to get a excavation license for that tomb. The motivation, we didn't just flip a coin and say, let's just, you know, find a tomb in Jerusalem we might try to enter. It's actually illegal to dig a tomb in Jerusalem. But what we had proposed is to go in with robotic camera equipment provided by General Electric and to do a kind of stealth examination of a tomb. So we were given the license. The way we entered the tomb was through the basement level of the condominium building. It's about 6 feet below that basement level, drilled 18-inch holes, got the camera in, this amazing robotic arm that was built actually by one of James Cameron's technicians in Toronto, enabled us to maneuver and actually go into a tomb, into the tomb. And it's as if It was very eerie, Frank. It was like I likened it to sort of moon landing feeling, like you're not in, but you're in this silent, forbidden territory. And what you find in a Jewish tomb, you don't find silver or gold or really anything of value in a conventional sense. But what you find are, of course, bones. And then these ossuaries or bone boxes, they're limestone boxes about the size of a length of a femur bone and the width of a skull. And in Jewish burial during this period, you could call it the time of Jesus or more technically the Herodian period, first century Jerusalem, the practice was to do cave burials and to lay out the corpse for a year to a year and a half. Once the flesh and organs decomposed, they would gather the bones and put them in these ossuaries. That becomes of interest to our camera investigation because on the ossuaries could be names, inscriptions, engravings, and so forth. So the ossuaries become, in some cases, a kind of a record of the past, oftentimes something that you could actually read in the case of names. And so that was the idea. The reason we went there, as you already mentioned in your introduction, was because it's less than 200 feet away from this other tomb, the Jesus tomb. And in 2008, there had been an academic conference in Jerusalem about the Jesus tomb. The papers will be published this fall by Erdmann's Press. About 50 scholars. I don't think we agreed on a single thing. But at the end, there was a resolution that someone should apply for a license and investigate the tomb 200 feet away because maybe it would contain something that would shed light on the other tomb. Because in this area of, it's south of Jerusalem, it's called Taupiot, it's a modern neighborhood, tombs were often clustered in family groupings. For example, on this plot of land, anciently there were three tombs. One is destroyed completely. One is the so-called Jesus family tomb that's actually been excavated, and then this new one, we'll call it Tomb B, that we're doing with the camera. So that's why we went there. I applied for the license through our university. I think we maybe might be the first university to ever get a license to excavate a tomb. Normally, what happens with tombs, they're like Indian mounds here in the United States. You're not allowed to locate one and then say, oh, I'd like to dig it, because that's simply not allowed for cultural reasons. But if a tomb has already been opened, by getting the agreement of the Haredim or the Orthodox religious groups that normally protest any kind of archaeological work in a tomb, we were able to bring them in as partners. We actually had a couple of guys with their black hats and tzitzit and earlocks standing right with us.
Well, let me ask
you. Really,
but yeah, I want to ask you a couple of questions, though, before we go
too much farther,
because I want to know how it is you are sure that this is from the Herodian period. How do you know that this is actually a tomb that was constructed around the time of Christ?
I think generally all the tombs of this type and description with these kinds of ossuaries date themselves from about 20-30 BC to 70 AD. By their style and their location. There's what's called a necropolis around Jerusalem from this period, well identified. Also, in that initial bulldozing of the tomb, the archaeologist Amos Cloner did go in for, he says, 15 or 20 minutes. He took some pictures, and we published some of those in our book, by the way, these unpublished photos. And he did bring out a pot that's from the first century and some other artifacts that indicate it's definitely a first century tomb.
And you said that this is near something that had been known as the Jesus family tomb. Why is it called that, and how did we know anything about that?
Yeah, the other tomb, let's call it A, 200 feet away, it was also discovered a year earlier, 1980, so it's 1980, 1981, by a bulldozer again. Bulldozers turn out to be the best archaeologists sometimes.
at least initially.
Yeah.
Rescue
archaeology. Mm. And if a tomb is opened accidentally, it is legal for a rescue team to go in. And for a brief period, usually just a few days, the tomb can be examined, the ossuaries taken out and studied, and the bones are then turned over to the religious for reburial. So that was done in 1980. And what was interesting about this tomb, it had 10 of these bone boxes. Six of them had names, and the names essentially came to the public knowledge in 2007. They were published in a journal in 1996, but I don't think anybody particularly noticed. But a film crew did notice in 2007, Jesus, son of Joseph, Mariamne, Yosei, Maria, and I guess most controversial, like Jude, son of Jesus. So for many scholars, the approach was these names are common, and that was what the debate was about at the conference in 2008. You know, you could have other Jesus, sons of Joseph. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's Jesus of Nazareth, which I think is certainly true. But what I have argued in my book and elsewhere in published articles, and you know, some scholars agree, is that statistically the cluster actually is significant, and it is very difficult to account for by random chance. And also two of the names, Mariamne and Yosei, are very rare nicknames. Mariamne only occurs three other times in all of Greek literature. That's spelled with an N, and both refer to Mary Magdalene. The other two, and then we've got this tomb. And Yosei is only on three other inscriptions, one ossuary in this tomb, and that's the nickname of Jesus' brother. So, you know, I think before we went to the second tomb, my sense was this should not be dismissed. It's possible, maybe even probable, but it can't be proven.
So now talk about, so you've got this tantalizing circumstantial evidence that's starting to point to perhaps a family tomb or a plot, an area. And on the second tomb, B, there are markings that are also interesting. So talk about those.
Yeah, two of the ossuaries, there are four or five things that are quite interesting in the tomb in terms of markings on the ossuaries, but two just knocked us off our chairs. First of all, a image that we took after some study to be a image of a fish with a human figure coming out of it, Jonah. Immediately, once we recognized it, we began to shout and yell. And there's a film called The Resurrection Tomb on Discovery Television that captures this moment. And what we derive from that is that that it's an early Christian symbol of resurrection based on the traditions in the Gospels like Matthew 12, where Jesus talks about the sign of Jonah and that he would be in the tomb 3 days and three nights like Jonah was in the fish. So like the cross and like the anchor and other early Christian symbols, the Jonah symbol became very popular, but not this early. This would be the first. I mean, if you go to Rome in the catacombs, there are over 100 images of Jonah getting spit out of the fish. It becomes the main symbol of Christian resurrection, but we didn't expect it in a first century tomb. And then just last week, James Charlesworth of Princeton Theological Seminary identified, and it's all over the news this morning, a four letters in the nose of the fish. It's very odd to look at. You can go on my blog, jamestabor.com, and see a picture of it. And it actually says in Hebrew, Yonah. So we've actually got his name written across the fish. So that's amazing. And what it says to us is that the bone box is portraying a kind of narrative of resurrection. And then next to it, a second ossuary in the same niche, there was a four-line Greek inscription. The translation is still being disputed, and they're different. Whenever you get an inscription like this, an epitaph, you know, you're going to get different readings. I published a paper at BibleInterp.com that has all of my suggestions for readings, but I would translate it as something like the Lord Jehovah, raise up, raise up, a kind of a plea for exaltation. And you know, whether it's talking about the person in that box, that that person wants to be raised up and calling upon God, or whether it's celebrating Jesus' resurrection, it doesn't say. But I've connected it to the text of Jonah. In the text of the book of Jonah in the Bible, chapter 2, Jonah says, O Lord Jehovah, lift me up from Sheol. And I think, you know, you've got three words that are exactly parallel. So I think it's also a Jonah inscription. So you've got a Jonah image and a Jonah inscription in a tomb 200 feet from a Jesus tomb, which then raises the obvious question, if this is the tomb of Jesus of Nazareth, he shouldn't have a tomb, first of all, if you take resurrection as literally the bones being taken up to heaven in traditional Christian understanding. So what were these people celebrating? And so what we argue in the book is that this is a earlier view of resurrection, that it's found in the Apostle Paul, that resurrection is not the corpse reviving. You have corpses going to dust. The Bible talks about those who are in the sea coming forth from the dead. So you're not talking about gathering corpses or decayed or perished bodies, but rather this notion that God can redesign and bring forth a spiritual body. And that's what Paul says. He says that resurrection is taking off your old clothes, being naked, your soul, and putting on new clothes. And this tomb would not be the tomb of Easter, by the way. That's important. In other words, the Easter tomb is in the city of Jerusalem where Jesus was crucified, traditionally the Church Holy Sepulchre. That would be a temporary tomb. Amos Cloner, the archaeologist, even suggested this, by the way, that that's a temporary tomb where Jesus is put because of Passover. Remember Friday night, they're rushing to get the body off the cross. What do you do with a corpse? It's Passover. You're going to eat the Seder that night. And so the body is put temporarily, and then Saturday or Sunday morning, it would be taken by Joseph of Arimathea to a permanent place. And yet, people began to see visions of Jesus, to claim they'd seen him. And I guess psychologists and historians might call them hallucinations. I prefer to just be a historian and record people claim these things without passing judgment. You know, it's pretty hard to pass judgment on somebody's spiritual experience.
So, but I'd have to point out that your interpretation of Paul is probably not the mainstream Christian interpretation of Paul. The mainstream interpretation of that and the resurrection is that it was a bodily resurrection. So you're reading Paul in a way that I would say most Christian ministers don't. Isn't that
That's
fair?
Right. Yeah. But I wouldn't say that it wasn't bodily. It was bodily. And Paul says, and this is all 1 Corinthians 5 and 15, he says that there's a spiritual body. He uses the word body, and a body of the dust. So it is a body. It's not a ghost, but it's a body. Remember, he passes through walls, he disappears, he comes and goes. Mm-hmm. So it's even reported as an ethereal body, much like an angelic appearance in the Hebrew Bible, you know, where an angel shows up, eats a meal with Abraham, and then poofs away. It seems to be that sort of experience as it's reported in the gospel text.
Do you think if we were to take your interpretation of this finding that it would fundamentally change the tenets of Christian faith?
I think what it would do would help clarify for people who maybe have trouble with imagining in the most literal sense that a natural body, a flesh and blood body, went up to heaven and that they're supposed to believe that, and yet they still would like to affirm their faith in Jesus's importance, even his exaltation, however they interpret that. That would change. Now, lots of theologians already would claim that. You know, the famous Dom Crossan, probably the most famous New Testament theologian, says, you know, I don't care about Jesus' bones. I believe he's raised from the dead. It's interesting that I guess we usually label these people liberal. I'm not a theologian, so I'm just trying to talk about what people might have believed in the first century.
Well, it's interesting, too, that Jesus makes reference to Jonah in the story when he talks about resurrection and saying, I will give you the sign of Jonah. Jonah famously in the belly of the whale for 3 days, spit out, and then on to Nineveh. No one really took that as literally, except, I suppose, for fundamentalists, but most mainstream Christians understand that story for what it is. Interesting that Jesus would use that in terms of his own resurrection, a story that wasn't meant to be taken literally.
You know, it's hard to know in that time, in the first century, if people took Bible stories more literally, like some people do today. But I agree with you. He's taking it as a image. He said as. He called it a sign of Jonah. So it doesn't mean exactly like Jonah. But as Jonah was this in the story, I will be that. That sort of correspondence.
And, of course, all these things are matters of faith. When you take the bodily, biological resurrection of Jesus as an article of faith, then forensics really never enter into it. It can never be demonstrated one way or another because faith is precisely that which cannot be proved. So I suppose the argument goes on forever.
It does. Now, in the book, Tomb A, the Jesus tomb, there were bone materials in the ossuaries of Jesus, son of Joseph, and Mariamne. And the reason they're there is when you dump bones out and rebury them, significant portions stick to the sides. And so we did test those bones. We did DNA, and we published the DNA results from two separate labs. They did independent blind tests, one in Toronto, or rather Canada, Ontario, and one at University of California, Davis. And so those DNA results, it's mitochondrial, you know, the mother's DNA. Mm-hmm. It tells us we don't have Jesus' DNA, so it tells us nothing. But what it does tell us is that Mariamne and Jesus were not related. In other words, it's not his sister or his mother, whoever this Jesus is. I laugh with my students. I say, let's just call him Jesus the baker. You know, why make this emotional? But the point is, it's a Jesus. It's a first century Jesus. And then you begin to talk about, are there any arguments for making this Jesus more than just another Jesus? And I think there are. And I challenge people to take a look at the book and see if they find it persuasive.
Well, one thing is certain. The argument itself is destined for life everlasting. James Tabor, thank you so much.
That's right. Lots of controversy out there, too. Yeah.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
James Tabor, chair of the Department of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte and co-author of the book The Jesus Discovery, the new archaeological find that reveals the birth of Christianity. You can read more about him at jamestabor.com. Up ahead, we preview Sha'Cory Hills with the music of Mandolin Orange. Stay with us on The State of Things.